A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who have shaped us, which is now out in paperback. If you like book chat, you might like to sign up to my newsletter. Find it at furtherreading.substack.com. And if you're listening on the day this is released, the 8th of April 2020, I will be live on Waterstone's Instagram tonight, interviewing our fabulous former guest, Holly Bourne, about her brilliant new novel, Pretending. We recorded this episode with Lissa Evans in North London on a very rainy day last October when the world looked and felt very different. Obviously, we're not able to record our series as usual and go into people's homes, and we've had to postpone some of the episodes that we were really looking forward to bringing you. But we hope that this one-off brings you some comfort and cheer. Anyone who is familiar with Lissa's wonderful books, most famously, Their Finest Hour and a Half, Old Baggage, and the Wed Wabbit children's series, will know that Lissa is just the best company. She's smart, she's warm, she's charming, she's joyous. Coming into her cosy home and nosing around her bookshelves was the literary equivalent of coming off a shipwreck and being given a crate of hot buttered crumpets and the run of an airing cupboard. Lissa is hot butter for the soul, and I hope you find this as uplifting as we did. Here is a really lovely combination of cookbooks and recipe books and novels and reference books. So, ooh, love, sex and war. That sounds exciting.
That's part of my World War II shelf. I've written two books set in World War II, and I'm writing a third. And I've accumulated an entire bookshelf full of World War II reference books at one point, but I've pruned them. So I'm now down to the essential stuff that was difficult to get or I particularly loved or that I will use again.
Do you have any favourites? Are there any books that just keep coming up?
This book here, which is called How We Lived Then by Norman Longman, that was published when I was about 13, and my elder sister bought it for my dad for one Christmas. She was a sociology student. And my dad said, you know, what do I need to read that for? I lived through it. But I took it and read it and reread it and reread it.
So this is the copy that he was given for Christmas?
No, sadly not, no. But it's been used as much as if it were. And it's not a very political book. It's not a sociological study of the home front like Juliet Gardner's later books, which I've got, Wartime Britain. But it's got tremendous detail about what it was actually like to live through it. Chapters about, you know, what you put in Christmas stockings or what you ate or what you listened to radio where you went on holiday during the war. And I read it and reread it and reread it, and it became a sort of obsession, the home front. So when I ended up actually writing a book set in it, I already had a sort of baseline of knowledge. This is if I had my own memories. So that's a real favourite.
I love that. I should say that I opened this on page 192. Between 192 and 193, the crowded classroom, this has been so read and so loved that it's in two separate volumes now. The glue has shattered on the spine.
That's right. There are so many that I love. I wrote a book set during the about the making of a film during the Second World War, their finest hour and a half. So I've got quite a lot of film books as well. There's The Celluloid Mistress, which is an extraordinary set during film 1930s, yes, about filmmaking. Beautiful. And look at the cover of it.
I promise I'm going to put these books back. Not to leave them. So there we have The Celluloid Mistress.
This is an autobiography, or part of an autobiography of a film writer set during the 1930s, and called Rodney Ackland. He was 19 when he had some plays on in London, and then he was pulled into the world of screenwriting. And yeah, it's covered in caricatures. I do, because there is Emlyn Williams, not very well known now, but whom I'm particularly fond of, because on that shelf there, a shelf of favourites, I've got his autobiography called George, which is one of the nicest, funniest, best autobiographies I know.
Oh, really? So can we have a look at it?
Yeah. Called George. This was given to me by the same sister who bought How He Lived Then, actually. Given to me when I was about 15. And Emlyn Williams was the son of a publican in North Wales. And he was very, very bright and very, very stage struck. And he got a scholarship to Oxford, and then he became an actor, and then he wrote a play called Knights Must Fall, which is still performed, a sort of piece of hokum, really, about a murderer with a head in a hat box. But anyway, he was a huge figure in British plays and films in the 30s and 40s, and then sort of fell away. I don't think he was a great actor, but he wrote an autobiography called George, and it's completely wonderful. It's beautifully written, it's sparkling, it's funny, it's idiosyncratic, and I think actually I absorbed some of his phraseology, and I think it's responsible for part of my own writing style.
That's interesting. That voice is I do wonder. Something that you...
Yeah, it's one of them. One of my major influences. Yeah.
I really love that as well, how you can have an autobiography or a biography, and even if the subject is sort of new to you or not very well known, that the story and the writing can be so compelling that you're swept into it anyway.
Absolutely. He wrote a follow-up volume called Emlyn, but that's slightly less interesting because he's famous by that point, you know.
No origin story. So did you and your sister read a lot of the same books or swap many books when you were growing up?
I've got two older sisters and I was heavily influenced by both of them. So they're sort of 9 and 6 years older than me. So their shelves were something I trawled through. And read a lot of books that they passed on, yes.
Were they quite open to you reading anything you found? Or were there any books where they said, oh, perhaps not this one just yet, but you had to sneak under a pillow?
They never did. I remember secretly bringing Lady Chatterley's Lover back to my room when I was about 13 or 14. That happened to be on one sister's bookshelves. But on the whole, though, they were very open about it. Or perhaps they didn't read the rude books at home either, you know.
Had a secret stash somewhere.
Yeah.
What did you think of Lady Chatterley at the time?
So boring, but the rude bits were great, you know. As much as I think of it now, really.
I often think with D.H. Lawrence, sometimes the rude bits, as you're going through it and going through it, and you're like, oh, she put forget-me-nots where?
Yeah, that's a bit I've never been a fan of D.H. Lawrence, I'm afraid. He's never, as an adult, it's never drawn me. God, it's the fact that nobody ever comes in and says, oh, you know, what's for tea tonight? You know, it's all so high flown. It's also painfully emotional. I can't enjoy it.
I think it takes a lot of confidence to say there are certain writers where it's difficult to say, oh, I feel like I really should love this writer a lot more than I do.
Yes.
It's a bit like I've had to read a lot of Thomas Hardy at school because I'm from Dorset. And it's like, oh, girls, you'll like this because it's where you are. Like, oh, I can see why he is important and why we must read him, but I'm... Well, there is no love here.
Absolutely. I'm in a slightly interesting situation at the moment because I occasionally appear on Backlisted Pod, but I've agreed to host one, a Christmas special, which is on Proust. Now, they've asked me to do it, I think, mainly because I've never read any Proust, so what a laugh I get, ignorant old this one. So I've decided to, and this is on the coffee table over here, to read around and then eventually read the first volume of Swans of Remembrance Things Past. So I am on a Proust reading binge, but an oblique Proust reading binge. So I'm at the moment reading Monsieur Proust, which is based on the memories of his maid Celeste, who appears in the books. I'm just about to read Lectures on Proust in a Soviet Prison Camp. Also, In Looking Back, One Learns to See, which is by Bergstein, which is about his attitude to the visual arts. I just read Alain de Botton's How Proust Can Change Your Life, which, to my amazement, is terrific.
Oh, really?
And I absolutely zapped through it.
Can I ask as well, are these, did you borrow these from the London Library?
I borrowed these
fabulous
from the London Library.
Big red London Library stickers on.
So I am trying to, and then I bought a copy because I knew I'd have to make notes of it, of Swan's Way, which I'm going to have to. I can't have something on Proust and not read.
Are you, as I suppose as well as somebody who, you know, does so much sort of research your own books, do you mind writing in books and bending back pages and things?
Or I don't mind at all. Unless they're beautiful hardbacks, in which case I won't. But virtually every book on that research shelf has got bits of paper in it and scribbles and so forth. No, I mean, books are for loving and handling.
Are you good at coming back and remembering what your notes were? Or do you ever look at anything and think, what was that?
Oh, well, yeah, no, I'm quite good at decoding my own execrable handwriting. Yeah, no, but I also do tons and tons and tons of typing up notes. Because otherwise they're worthless. You have to be able to word search.
Are there many things that you find that you sort of were captivated by but then didn't quite fit for a book but you found later?
There's lots of things that stay in my head or anecdotes. You think, oh, I can use that, but not in this book. Yes, I do quite a lot of that. And I normally got a file for each book, which I call somewhat naffly inspiration, which are things that just sit in my head and I put them into a single file and look through them if I'm feeling a bit dull.
Does it take a lot of discipline to know this is great but not for this, or have you always had quite a good kind of editor's mind
I'm quite a good self-editor because I came from radio and TV. I was a script editor and I ruthlessly edit my own books, so yeah. And I spent about 2 days refining a paragraph which was all, you know, a long extended metaphor, and in the end I thought, I can refine it as much as I like. It has nothing to do with what comes before or after it, and I deleted it and felt much, much better. So you have to know, you have to listen to your heart on these.
Well, coming from that world, that's a brilliant discipline to have. I suppose as well, for really hearing things.
Yeah,
as well,
it's the one. I mean, in radio, it's all you've got, isn't it? All you've got is the words, so it's the best possible training as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, I mean, I do some rewrites at the end, but generally by the time I get to the end of a book, it's about 90% there.
Can we look at that bookshelf behind you while we're here?
There's quite a lot of art books. My husband's very interested in art, so a lot of those are his. And then they're just like all my bookshelves, I like to think they're eclectic. But, you know, they're basically a total jumble. A total jumble.
Oh, brilliant. You've got two of my favourites here. Victoria Wood.
Oh, Victoria Wood scripts.
Together.
Balmy and Up to You, Porky. Yeah, fabulous. I've got a lot of scripts. And it wasn't just coming from radio or TV. I was interested in them. I got the Fawlty Towers scripts when I was about 13. Like lots of people I know who worked in comedy. I've been obsessed with comedy since I can remember. Molesworth made me laugh at 6 or 7, and I've never stopped looking for things that make me laugh.
I love that having the sort of, I think knowing...
It's Molesworth.
Knowing yourself as a writer and knowing that D.H. Lawrence, not for me, not inspiring, not useful. Molesworth, absolutely. Yes. I totally agree with you.
I know, it's terrible, isn't it? But there's no... as you can see, my books are not organised by any means at all, apart from, you know, I've got a shelf of gardening books, but this has got non-fiction, fiction, new.
Well, this is a book that I've heard about and wanted to read, but never actually seen. I dare say I could have made more of an effort and looked for it. You have The American Way of Death by Jessica Mitford about the
Funeral business. Well, I've always been a fan of Jessica Mitford since reading Ons and Rebels when I was about 10 or 11. And her journalism is exceptionally good. And The American Way of Death is a fantastic skewering of the American funeral business, which she wrote, I think, in the 60s. And it's very, very funny, and very little has changed. But later on, I produced an adaptation of The Loved One, War's The Loved One, for radio. And I used a lot of the description of The American Way of Death as an inspiration. In fact, I sent a copy of the radio adaptation to Jessica Mitford. I don't know how I got the address. And I got a postcard back saying, you know, it had brought her great joy, which I thought was so Jessica-ish. And I was so happy.
And what an incredible thing. Do you still have it somewhere?
Somewhere I have, yes, filed away, yeah. So I've always been a tremendous fan. I've got the makings of a Muckraker here, which is another anthology of her journalism.
Oh, I didn't know about good. That.
She's terrific. She wrote another one called The American Prison Business about the exploitation of American prisoners. There's a very funny one about an enormously expensive creative writers course that you could sign on to in America, and what a cheat it was. Let us now appraise famous writers, it's called. They're all... I love short pieces. I always have done. That's what I read in bed generally.
And I suppose as well that comes back to that sense of economy and having to make everything
and
count
precision.
And everything is essential.
Absolutely.
And I think as well that she was definitely one of the first writers I came across that you can write about very serious things and factual things and be funny and make that impactful rather than it, you know, taking away from the meaning of the
That's
writing.
That's absolutely true, yeah. And I think perhaps if I've got anything that unifies my taste, it's a liking for, concision and precision. I don't like splurges.
Oh, what's that book there?
Oh, this is The Faber Book of Reportage,
ooh,
which is wonderful. Again, it's a, and in fact, this was one of the first, when I met my husband, which was very late on, we didn't meet until I was in my 40s. It's one of the first things we talked about. He's upstairs somewhere. The Faber Book of Reportage, which is pieces of journalism, starting from Plague in Athens, which Thucydides wrote in 430 BC, and it goes on from there right up to the you know, Vietnam reporting.
Brilliant.
And so forth.
Is that your copy or his copy?
There's no name in it, so who can tell?
Do you have much in the way of sort of overlapping tastes? Do you lend each other books?
Yes. Yeah, he tends to read a lot of political stuff and non-fiction political critiques, which don't appeal to me, but we've got a certain crossover with art books, and he likes short stories too, which I like very much.
Who are your favourite short story writers?
Elizabeth Taylor would be my favourite. The right, Devastating Boys.
I mean, look at that, because I saw that title and I was like, wow, that's such a great name.
I mean, she's a wonderful writer, but I actually prefer her short stories even to her novels. Oh, there it is. I bought this particular copy because this is the copy I found in Litchfield Library. Well, it's the same edition. Litchfield Library, when I was about 13 or 14.
Oh, that is fabulous. Does it say it was 24p on the front flap?
20p.
I thought 24 would be an odd, specific sort of number.
And I recognised the cover, and I must have got it out of Litchfield Library about 25 times. And I think this book is perfection. There isn't a story in it which isn't... doesn't grab you by the heart, and some of them are deeply tragic, one or two of them are very funny, and most of them are a combination. They're quite extraordinary. I can't recommend it enough. God, I love this book.
Such a great title.
It's very good. I've got a lot of books of ghost stories as well, short stories, which I absolutely love. And I've got here's another short story collection, which is Dorothy Whipple stories. Dorothy Whipple I read for the first time last year and read all of her books in a great gulp.
Isn't that the best though, when you find someone and you think, oh, hello.
Absolutely fantastic. And this is a joy. Her books are they're of their time, but they're also universal, like all the best books.
When was she writing?
20s, 30s, no, 30s, 40s, 50s.
But I like the look of the girl's budget.
Oh, the girl's budget. No, this was bought by my husband because this is for Old Baggage. This is the kind of girls gang that appears in Old Baggage. There's a girls group called the Amazons that runs around on Hampstead Heath and throws javelins and things. And the girl's budget was, I think, it's published a little earlier than that. I think it's Edwardian. But it's full of stirring tales of there's a picture here on the frontispiece. They strained until they thought their arms must crack, and it's too... well, there's a girl and a boy, but the girl's in oilskins, and they seem to be pulling at a wreck with ropes from the top of a cliff, which they seem unlikely to be able to carry that off.
The picture is confusing as well. They're sort of in the foreground, and then the wreck looks like it came out of a bottle.
That's right, and they've got they're fabulous short stories. So some rather light, and some about tremendous adventure. She'll do it, he muttered. She'll just do it. There's a guy in a boat in a very, very high sea. So that's the girl's budget. And also, I was very keen on that kind of cover for Old Baggage. And I did end up with that kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, that looks fabulous. It's interesting because I think now there's all this conversation about, you know, we need more strong women in culture, and where are the strong women? They've always been there, haven't they?
It drives me absolutely mad. Yes, of course, they've always been there. A big, strong woman just means a woman with a big personality. Mm. Who hasn't known one of those in the, going back generations in their family?
Well, you'd hope, wouldn't you?
Yes, absolutely. One of my favourite things, the most useful things for me writing, were books are actually written and published during the war, because then you would know that everything in them was precise. And one of my favourite books that I read many times was this book called Raiders Overhead, Diary of the London Blitz by Barbara Nixon, who is, there she is, there's a picture of her.
She's a strong woman, isn't she?
Splendid looking woman in ARP uniform. And she was an ex-actress who became a full-time warden during the Second World War. And it is, and she's a socialist, and she's witty, and she presents such a vivid picture. And she's also, and this happens quite a lot, quite critical of aspects of government policy, quite critical of social care during this time. And they were allowed to publish that. You know, it's quite interesting that actually during a war, she was allowed to slag off the government.
Ah.
And that's quite a common thing that I find in some of my World War II collections.
Yeah. I'm pleasantly surprised by that.
Yes. Here's another one, Post D by John Strachey, which is a fantastic little edition.
Some experiences of an air raid warden. That is another beautiful, beautiful copy.
It's amazing, isn't it? And again, he wrote this, he became a part-time warden, and this is published in 1941. And what I love about this book, again, you get a real taste for what the physical aspects of things during the Second World War, because it's got very small margins, it's very meanly published, you know, it has a paper cover that's mainly come off, it's a very small font. Stuff was published, but it wasn't published in the style that it had been before the war.
You've got the previous owner, I think, has written their name very neatly.
Unreadable. Will something?
I see an I. It's very sort of very precise writing, though. Maybe it's some kind of code.
Maybe it is. But yes, it's a terrific book. This this shelf here has got a lot of my favourite stuff I read again and double copies. Here's possibly the favourite book I read in the last year, which is Roger Deakin's Waterlog. And he was a fantastic guy. He was possibly one of the first psychogeography writers. And he loved swimming outdoors. He had a sort of moat on his Norfolk farm, and he decided to swim Britain. And Roger would plunge into anything, freezing sea, a tiny tarn on a moor, a river. And it's wonderfully written, and it's got all the joy of swimming, plus a lot of interesting sociology and geography. I love this book.
So when was it written?
It was written, I think, 1998 or something. Oh, no, this was 1999, that's right. And it's a good book. What else? Go on.
American Way of Death Revisited.
That's right. And I've got lots of double copies on here, because I've got at least two copies of The Rings of Saturn on here, which is W.G. Sebald, one of my favourite books. Fabulously gloomy story, looping on story. I've got two copies, I see, of Dipped in Vitriol, which is a fantastic anthology of hatchet reviews. Oh, this is one of my favourite books.
Ooh.
Early Havoc by June Havoc. Now, June Havoc was the little sister. She was baby June. Gypsy's little sister.
Ah. Yeah,
you know Gypsy Rose Lee?
Yes.
And it's her side of the story. And both she and her sister, although completely uneducated formally, because their mother was an absolute monster who dragged them round, both really good writers. Gypsy Rose Lee became a detective story writer and was very good. And this is brilliantly written account.
I wasn't sure what you were going to say then. I thought Gypsy Rose Lee became a detective
story writer. That's right. Well, this is a fantastic account of life on the road and the last years in music hall. But also, after she breaks away from the family. Do you remember in the film, Baby June runs away?
Yeah.
Well, she does run away, and she marries very, very young and then splits up. But she's got no money at all, and she takes part in dance marathons. And it is the most brilliant, detailed description of dance marathons.
Like
and
him, they shoot horses, don't
I
they?
Think he must have read it. I think he must have read this, because it's such detail and it's so brilliant. And this is one of my all-time favourite books.
Oh, how brilliant. I'm so glad that exists.
I know, it's really good. It's
really thrilling. Wow. I think you've got some of more of my favourites. The Armistead Maupin. More Tales and Further Tales.
My favourites are the ones that are more real. The fantasy plots don't. I mean, I love Armistead Motorboat, but the fantasy plots don't interest me as much.
And so I particularly not love the Grace those Cathedral, two. Cannibals, no, and Amnesia.
They
and
don't do it for me. No. So I love his more inconsequential interactions between ordinary, except they're all extraordinary people. And again, I prefer the later ones. You know, Marianne in Autumn. And yes, that kind of thing I absolutely adore.
Because I do. I love the way he writes. I think, again, he's a really good economist with the dialogue and how much it tells you about the people and absolutely about what's happening to them.
Absolutely. And in fact, I did the, when I went to San Francisco, I did the, you know, the tramping around trying to find Barbary Steps, just like everybody. Yeah, he's wonderful. What else we got here? One of my all-time favourite books, Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard book, which is one of those books. I mean, I haven't read a great deal of Neil Gaiman. I know some people are absolutely fanatical about him, and I don't know that I've read any of his purely adult book. This book, I think, is so wonderful, and it's one of those books that so strikes me as so perfect. It's almost, when I read it, it was almost like it had always been there, and I just hadn't read it before. It's a book that, you know, it's like a fossil. It's always been there in time, and I was lucky enough to find it. I think it's the most magnificent book. And it's right next to another book that I've read and reread, which is Annie Prue now. She used to be E. Annie Prue, The Shipping News. And I love this book, but I particularly love this book because my mother was the fastest reader in the world. I mean, she read so fast that we used to sort of test her. We didn't really believe she could read that fast. And she particularly loved this book. And she used to read it once a year. And now I read it once a year, and it's like having a conversation with my mum every time I read
really
it.
That's lovely. Was there a particular time that she liked to, like, was there a season that was time for The Shipping News?
Maybe coming up to Christmas, because that's reminding me. She loved all sorts of books, but during Lent, she used to give up chocolate and detective stories.
Oh!
That was her, you know, so she regarded detective stories as her vice. But yes, maybe Shipping News is Christmas. I mean, I love it. It's so rich, it's so dense, and it's, again, a mass of stories. God, I do love stories.
Really, like a Christmas pudding.
Yeah.
Something really new in every bite.
That's absolutely how it is. In fact, that's one of the discussions I have with Andy Miller, because plot is not as important to him as it is to me. And for me, it's half of everything.
Well, me and Andy Miller both love Anita Bruckner very much. And she's not wild about plot.
She's not wild about plot. And in fact, I was fairly resistant to her until, again, talking to the mighty, influential Andy Miller, and I read The Latecomers and was knocked sideways by it, and also Look at Me, and then I read Hotel du Lac, and I thought, I'm really glad I didn't read Hotel du Lac first, because I really thought it was absolute nonsense.
Do you think, because that's the book, and I think it puts a lot of people off, and it's like,
it's written in the 70s, might as well have been written in the 1920s. I shouldn't be saying this, should I? But anyway, there we go.
It's right, and she's not going to come for us, it's fine.
This is another favourite book. This is Florence King, Confessions of a Failed Southern Lady.
Oh, that looks great.
It's one of the funniest books I know. She takes no prisoners. She grew up in the 1950s. She had a fantastically eccentric parents. And she had her grandma, who lived with them, was a Southern belle, who had totally failed with her own daughter, Florence King's mother. Grandma had built a gazebo for her daughter to receive visitors in, and the mother actually hung a punch ball in the gazebo. That's what Florence King's mother was like. So this is the story of Florence King's years on the anvil as her grandmother tries to hammer her into a Southern lady, and she fails totally. And in fact, the last she loves her grandma, but the last sentences, the last paragraph is of the introduction is, "This is the story of my years on her anvil. Whether she succeeded in making a lady out of me is for you to decide, but I will say one thing in my own favour before we begin. No matter which sex I went to bed with, I never smoked on the street." Isn't that brilliant? And my mum loved this book as well. I absolutely love it. It's brilliantly funny.
I just read a book, and it's a collection of essays, and helpfully I can only remember that the author is called Helen, but it's called Southern Lady Code, and it's great fun. It's very, they're lovely because they are quite kind of inconsequential, but in a nice way, a lot of detail about nothing, but very funny. And it's a sort of, you know, if you can't say anything nice, say it like a Southern lady. And I think she lives in New York now, but it's sort of the rules that she grew up with and how she sort of lives with them now. But it's great fun.
I'm sure she knew that, but part of Florence Kings is how Southern ladies say everything three times. It's kind of like the Catholic version. It's like the Southern version of a novena, you know. Everything's recycled.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
We'll be back to Lissa soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, a book more valuable than an Ocado delivery slot. This week, it's I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith. I first read this when I was a teenager. Producer Dale read it for the first time last week, so you may well have read it before, but reading it again has moved me profoundly. Just to give you a quick refresher on the story, it's all about the Mortmains. They live in abject poverty in a crumbling castle, and 17-year-old Cassandra is writing and narrating their lives. We meet her beautiful, frustrated sister Rose, her glamorous, kind and vaguely pagan stepmother Topaz, her father, who's broke after writing one brilliant book that he just can't follow up, and how their lives are completely transformed when the Cotton Brothers arrive from America. And they find themselves captivated by the castle and its residents. This is a weird, funny, beautiful, magical and devastating book. And I've forgotten so much of Cassandra's wisdom, of Topaz's utter kindness, and the fact that this book has the only literary clergyman I can bear to spend any time with. Even if you've read it, it's worth reading it again. And if you're meeting the Mortmains the first time, oh, this is going to break you in the loveliest way. It's the ultimate comfort read, only because it is desperately and profoundly comforting to know that other people find life exactly as desolate, abundant, joyous, broken, nourishing, faded, technicolor, overwhelming and love and fear-filled as you do. I Capture the Castle is published by Vintage and it's also available for download on Audible. Now back to Lissa. But I understand you worked on Father Ted.
Oh, yes, I'm happy to talk about it. I've got the...
pretty much my favourite thing in the whole world. And I've often thought in the unlikely event I ever go on Mastermind, I might do Father
Ted. Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, really? Here's I've got a book here called Beyond Belief, which is a book of essays by somebody who was in an episode of Father Ted, Liam Fay. But yeah, no, I'm always happy to be asked about it because it's so easy for me
to
talk about
it. Who was Liam Fay?
Oh, he had
Dancing Priest.
No, he had a tiny part in... No, Dancing Priest is based on the guy on the cover, but Liam Fay had a small part in the Christmas Ted. That's all. He was one of the Graham Arthur's mates, I think.
Oh, in the getting lost in the
he won the priests priest of the year award.
In which
he was heaving with priests. There were so many.
But thinking about Catholicism and weird rules and repetitions, I think I love it so much because I grew up in a very, very, very strict Catholic family.
Oh, okay. So it'll mean even more to you than it does to me, probably. But I'm always delighted to talk about it because it was such an intense period of my life that I remember everything about it. I'm always hoping somebody will pin me down and ask me specifically about how we cast somebody or where the prop came from. There's nothing I wouldn't be happy to answer on it.
Oh, brilliant. I'm delighted. This episode of Your Book is about to be very, very different. Or maybe we can talk about, and this is me being like, I I'm a big fan and I know everything about it and immediately manage to forget everything. But the episode where the glamorous lady novelist comes.
Oh,
and
the first
she
series.
The
I
books.
Didn't do the first series. That was Geoffrey Perkins. I was just a fan of that. So I did the second and third series. Damn it. That was very funny, wasn't it? Really brilliant. Gemma Craven played the actors,
I did like that sort of... It's interesting, I think, how... I don't know if that sort of writer exists in that way anymore. And there's been lots of talk, I think, about how, like, bonkbusters are dead. Like, no, bonkbusters are back and they're bigger than ever. And what is a bonkbuster? But that period of it being a sort of fantastically glamorous enough to sort of bring, you know, a bit of glamour to Craggy Island.
Yes. Except her books are full of filth, aren't they? Filth.
Yes.
Absolute
Ride
filth.
Me sideways. That was another...
Oh, how much Pauline must have enjoyed doing that bit of the script. God. This here is an example of another genre I absolutely love. We talked about comedy books, but this is the type of book I can read sitting on the sofa, and it's about people suffering tremendously during adventures. And I do love that, anything Arctic, deserts or whatever. But this book, A Voyage for Madmen by Peter Nichols, is one of my all-time favourite books. I've given it to so many people, and it's the story of the 1970-something or other, round-the-world yacht race, single-handed yacht race, the time when there was no GPS, in which you really were on your own in the middle of the ocean. And what actually happened was beyond fiction. It was the most perfect and awful sort of combination of circumstances, which resulted in a winner, which resulted in one man going mad and throwing himself at the boat.
Can we have
another
a look
one.
At that? There's a picture you just flipped past, and it's just the most unhappy looking man I've ever seen.
Well, that's Matisse. Oh, no, he was wonderful. Matisse. He was a French sort of philosopher who was also a brilliant yachtsman who was in the lead, went all the way round, and then decided just to carry on, not to go into Britain and get the prize, but carried on. He went all the way round and ended up onto Fiji or something, being philosophical.
Wow.
And because of that, he threw a whole load of other circumstances, threw a spanner in the works, and it resulted in extraordinary tragedy and triumph. It is brilliant. It was reissued, I think, last Christmas, and I'm not surprised.
So what is it that you think about these stories? What is it that appeals to you so much? Is it that you can read them on your sofa and know that you're not cold on a boat?
Yeah, absolutely. It gets my, pulse up and my adrenaline rushing round while knowing that there's a cup of coffee within reach. I absolutely love it. I'm a completely, complete physical coward myself. So, I can put myself in the shoes of some people at Barnes without any danger.
And it's almost like proof. They did it, so we don't have to.
Well, of course. I mean, I wouldn't dream of it. Even dinghy sailing puts me off. Yeah.
It does seem a bit mad, doesn't it? I suppose. Why would you do that?
I don't know. And it was extraordinary. I mean, they were all on their own with no communication.
Here's another one.
Oh, Night to Remember. Yes, Night to Remember. This is a fantastic edition, isn't it? It's the Walter Lord's electrifying minute-by-minute story of the sinking of the Titanic.
Wow, it's a lovely corgi edition.
It's a lovely
corgi
edition. And when my kids were very little, we used to show them the black and white version of the Night to Remember, which they thought for many, many years was Titanic. And I've never forgotten the outrage in which they realised that they were talking about a completely different film to their schoolmates.
Can you imagine
how cruel of us.
They come over. We watch Titanic.
I know. Those are the
it's
days when
Titanic.
We could. Well, that's right. Those are the days when we could get them to watch black and white films.
Oh, it's a Hollywood Babylon there in
Hollywood Babylon. This is an old book, the scandal about scandals in Hollywood, and I quite enjoyed this book. But the book I really enjoyed was Shepperton Babylon, written by Matthew Sweet.
Ooh,
Matthew Sweet, who's just a wonderful writer. And
sorry,
that's
me.
A man who knows about so much, such a polymath. And Shepperton Babylon, which is a picture on the front of Dirk Bogarde in leather trousers. And it's so enjoyable.
I must say, Dirk Bogarde, his hip measurement is probably the same as around my thigh in that picture.
That's true. And I found this fantastic. I mean, my excuse was I was reading it for the background of one of my characters in their finest hour and a half, who was an actor who'd come up through silent movies. So it was fantastically useful for me. And in the film, ends up being played by Bill Nighy, actually. But there is a wonderful chapter about Dirk Bogarde insisting in a very bizarre film called, I think, The Singer, Not the Song.
Yeah.
Which John Mills must have deeply regretted being in, because it turned out to be incredibly homoerotic. And Dirk Bogarde in the tightest leather trousers, most leathery, shiny, tighty trousers you can possibly imagine, who turned up with them on the kind of first day of shooting.
Not my own costume.
But it's fantastically enjoyable. And it made me, it's such a good book and so entertaining, but also gave me, really good insight into what I was writing about. And also made me think there's a book to be written, probably not by me, but on the very early days of silent cinema, when anybody could do it. You could, buy a big camera and do it in your shed. And most extraordinary movies were made for no money by people with no prior ability and probably precious little talent. And that was the start of the movie industry.
Early YouTube.
Well, yes, that's exactly what it was like, only perhaps with a little more ambition. Very few YouTubers use more than one camera. But it's absolutely amazing. I love this book.
Are you quite good when you know what you're researching about being focused? Or do you ever sort of pick something up and think, there might be something in this, there might not. I'll see if the spirit moves me.
Oh, absolutely. My research is completely random. I just follow my nose. A lot of looking at bibliographies at the back of books and then following up more obscure things. But also, one of my greatest moments of research was in the Imperial War Museum when I didn't really know what I wanted. I wanted something on film. And they provided me with the three boxes, which were the archives of Sidney Bernstein, who turned out to be the special advisor of the Ministry of Information Film Department. And at the end of the war, somebody just upended a filing cabinet into three boxes. And it was absolutely brilliant. And it gave me the whole central premise of Their Finest Hour and a Half. And, there's nothing like touching ephemera. Actual letters written at the time in a tiny bit, A5 wartime, tiny margins all doubled up or written on the back, and telegrams, and oh, it's marvellous.
Oh, wow. And knowing no one was writing those, thinking that, trying to do the maths, 50, 60, ago. 70, 80 odd years later that you would be...
I know, absolutely fantastic. But what it did tell me was that, I tried to be really accurate in the books, but I got a fantastic correspondence between Sidney Bernstein and some guy in Hollywood. They were making Mrs. Miniver. And Sidney Bernstein was trying to remember something about the sequence of sirens in the first year of the war. And he couldn't remember whether a siren had gone off during the wartime broadcast or not. And the thing was, this was about 18 months later. So they'd already forgotten. People already forgot. Things moved so fast. So being an absolute stickler is not as necessary as one might think, as long as you come up with something that did happen.
Yes.
To one person, then it happened to a lot of people.
And people aren't. I mean, I think it possibly feels a bit like this now in internet times, but people aren't going looking for things. Like, oh, well, that was wrong and that wasn't quite right.
Very few people. I did get a letter saying, I think you'll find the Pepto-Bismol wasn't around the 40s. At which point I get really cross thinking, I've got an advert for Pepto-Bismol, so you are wrong. But,
come to your house. I've got your address and I've got this advert.
I brought down a couple of books here and...
Lovely. So we've got Flamingo Feather by Lauren Vanderpost.
The reason I got this is because when you open it,
you've got some flamingo feathers in it.
And I got these in the Carmargue, a bunch of them as flamingos flew off. So that's the reason. I don't particularly like the book, and there's Lissa Evans' July 1980 in it. And I basically keep the book because of the feathers in it.
I don't think I've ever actually seen any flamingo feathers. They're just so gorgeous.
They're extraordinary. They're sort of white shaded to glorious pink at the end. Yeah. So there we go. Book as box. As opposed to, I don't know, I finished a Lawrence Vanderpost.
Many functions. And did you, the Kenneth Williams
diaries. Well, this is particularly, because I'm in them.
No!
Yes, I know.
Oh, my God.
Let me find... it doesn't actually fall open the page. I'm not that vain, so I'm going to have to look at it.
I think you'd be forgiven.
7-6. What it was I started in radio, and I'll be able to say the year when I look this up. I started in radio in 1987, and the first thing I actually produced, because we were always given old war horses to produce, I produced a series called The Law Game, and it was what they got in. They got in three guests... And then some actors would reenact some sort of small claims court legal cases. But then when I walked into the green room, it was Nerys Hughes, Dr. Stefan Buchatsky, and Kenneth Williams.
Wonderful.
And Kenneth Williams, my first show. And it was It was absolutely also quite a mad woman who was in the audience who decided to come and sit in the green room, which was very common in the Paris studio there, which was in Lower Regent Street. But the reaction of the audience to Kenneth Williams and was just extraordinary. And he had a lovely evening and he really enjoyed it. But he wrote about it. Saturday, 5th of December, 1987. Walk to Paris studio for the Law game. Oh, no, here we go. I was wrong. On the panel with me were Neris Hughes and Ian McCaskill. So I had good company. One of the actors in the playlets was called Stephen Dish. And producer made him re-record a terribly difficult bit of comedy patter. Agony. I told Lissa Evans, producer, it was wicked of you. And she said, ah, but I'll keep most of his first reading. So I kissed her and said, oh, you're a cracker. Shaw Taylor presided suavely over both programmes. And I didn't realise, you know, and suddenly...
So how did you know? Did someone told me.
Someone said, did you know you're in it? Isn't that funny?
Oh, how fabulous.
So it's my tiny bit of fame, that one, yeah, yeah. And
excellent.
Underneath Lawrence van der Post is a book that I've read recently. I absolutely love. This is Catherine Heine's Standard Deviation, and it's so funny and so brilliantly written. This is a second-hand copy because I've bought and given my copies to so many people now. And it's set in New York, and it's about... it's about all sorts of things, but it's about a second marriage, and the parents have a son who is autistic, and it's about everything really, but what it mainly is fantastically funny and humane and compassionate. And it's got a Thanksgiving dinner in it, which is a magnificent set piece of comedy. And I love this book. I've read it twice. I'm undoubtedly going to read it again quite soon.
See, I like cosy books.
You like cosy books? Well, let's have a look on here. See, here's a cosy book. Lark Cries to Candlefolk. This is a very old edition, and this belonged to my auntie, Ironoy Evans. Auntie Ron, she was known as. And this was on our bookshelves when I was growing up, and I must have started reading it when I was 7 or 8. And I never read it all the way through. It's very discursive, and you can read each chapter separately, like a novel. But I loved it. I loved it. And when I look back to, you know, slightly boring adolescence, normal childhood and a boring adolescence, I think of all the stuff I read, and thank God I did, because it's the basis of everything I do and everything I think, really. And, you know, I think if there had been computers around then, I would have been sidetracked on computer games. I love puzzles and games and that kind of thing. And I wouldn't have read all this stuff, and it wouldn't be in my head. And the fact I've got a ridiculously large vocabulary, which I can use in Scrabble and things, is entirely due to reading this sort of thing.
And it's when you find it when your brain is at its sort of bendiest and most absorbent.
Stuff I learned then, and including poetry, because I had a wonderful teacher when I was about 11 who decided to give us all a team point if we learned 10 poems off by heart. You know, and I picked up about, you know, 10 team points in one term. But the poems I learned then, I largely still know. And I can't do it now. I can't.
I won't ask you to kind of recite them, but can you remember what the poems are?
Well, Kubla Khan's one, or Ulysses, you know, some long ones, some very short ones. Yeah, I can remember them all. Yeah.
Tennyson Ulysses.
Yeah.
I love that poem.
The Nidal King, by the still half among these barren crags, matched with the aged wife, I meet and dole unequal laws unto a savage race, etc. Yeah. And it's there, it's in your head. And another book on the shelves here, actually, it's over here, is relevant to this, because I did an evening called The Books That Made Me a Writer. With Mrs. Trevuse,
yes,
Helen Brockerbach.
I love her.
She's wonderful. And
brilliant.
One of the things I chose was the English hymnal, because I went to a church junior school and spent many, many, what feels like days in school assembly, but singing hymns. And the vocabulary of hymns, long before I knew what half the words meant, shaped my love of language. And, you know, you look at something like Hills of the North Rejoice, you know, Pent Beach, Warring Breeze. What does that mean when you're 7? But it doesn't matter because it stays in your head.
The rhythm is so insistent and so confident. And the way that things are bent and things are kind of edged. And you sort of... I think it means you feel comfortable taking a lot of liberties later, which is a very good thing.
That's a very good point. The horned moon that shines by night mid her spangled sister's bright. And that made me think of spangles at the time, obviously. But the whole concept of spangle. And, you know...
There's another Tennyson poem. I think, is it The Lotus Eaters? And there's a bit, I'm going to get this wrong. The foaming, crisping ripples of the spray of the sea. I always thought of those Kinder Bueno bars with the creamy stuff.
Absolutely. Yes, I know. Yes, it's funny. Yes, I know. I know another poem which was talks about crisp sea foam that always made me think of kind of quavers. Yeah, yeah. kind of thing. And the word enroll and extol. I remember thinking very strongly that enroll sounded like a kind of savoury Marmite roll, possibly a steam pudding, like Mr. Tumnus the Four, no, the beavers cooked in, yes, Narnia, that kind of roll.
And I think we should do an anthology. Savoury food for thought.
Savoury food for thought. So for me, it's so important, the richness of language that I grew up with.
And that it can sit in your head for you to kind of unlock or reach for when you're ready for it. Yeah. And you can carry it with you, but you don't necessarily have to know it all.
No, that's absolutely true. And when I wrote a book called Small Change for Stuart, and a subsequent one, Big Change for Stuart, a children's book, and Stuart's father in it is a crossword compiler who speaks in ludicrously polysyllabic language. And I really enjoyed doing that. And what I always tell the children when I go and do school visits is, the thing is, I hardly have to look up any of the words. They were all in my head already. Let me see if I can find a particular bit. This is a bit where Stuart and his father go to the local museum, where the museum keeper is very, very interested in Roman remains. "If you're interested in ballistae," said a loud voice behind him, "then you'll find a further collection of Roman siege engines in room 4. Stuart turned to see a man in a checked suit. He was wearing a badge that said Rod Felton, Chief Curator. "In particular, there's a post-classical example known as an onager," he added. Stuart's father looked up keenly. "I believe the name onager is also the Latin for wild ass," he said. Rod Felton almost jumped with delight. "That's absolutely correct. It's derived from the kicking action of the machine, which in turn is the result of torsional pressure from a twisted rope. And the latter medieval version, the mangonel, was also..." And Stuart goes off and explores the museum while Greek has met Greek, so to speak. But anyway, I loved writing him. Scrabble dictionary. I was playing Scrabble last night, and I love playing Scrabble. I played with Carrie Rosen and Sara Manning and Fanny Blake. So it's a writers' foursome in the local Oaxaca. But yes.
Oh, amazing! So this is live Scrabble. I assumed you were playing these people.
No. We're going to take over two tables in Oaxaca and eat and drink and play Scrabble. Yeah, I played last night. One, lost one. Here we go. This is one of my all-time favourite books, and it's...
Oh, I think that's quite a cosy read, My Family and Other Animals.
My Family and Other Animals, which I remember so strongly reading. I was about 10, and we'd gone to Wales camping, where we used to camp in South Wales in the Black Mountains. And for some reason, I wasn't in the tent, I was sleeping in our car. I think one of my sisters brought along a school friend. There wasn't any room, so I was sleeping in the back seat of the car. And I woke up early and it was raining, and I looked around for something to read, and there was the book that my sister was reading, which was My Family and Other Animals. I didn't know anything about it. And I started reading it, and it was like somebody had blown open the wall and let sunshine in, and I read it all day, and I walked between meals reading it, and I read it every moment of the day, and I finished it that evening. And I could not believe it, because as well as I was always interested in wildlife anyway, as well as the wildlife aspects, it was so funny. It made me laugh so much. And I read it and reread it and reread it. And when we eventually did it in school, I was a little bit miffed, because I regard it as my book. I didn't really want to share it with anyone
else. Other people have heard of this? Gerald Darrell?
He's my Gerald Darrell.
Did your sister love it as much as you did?
No, not as much.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did you feel a little bit like, oh, well, you can't have it then?
Yes. You're the wrong person to read it. I am the right person. I think it's mainly because I'm as obsessed with wildlife as well. So it's the double whammy of funniness and wildlife, yeah.
Because there are lots of, I think, you know, really great, really beautifully written nature books and various guides at the moment. But I find some of them quite earnest. And to have that where you can be really funny and spirited and observant,
it's
quick.
It's still unusual. I do read quite a lot of nature books, but I particularly love ones with a bit of funniness in them. Yeah.
Now, here I see Jane Gardam, The Queen of the Tambourine. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I've never read Jane Gardam, and I know I will love her. But she did, I think, one of my all-time favourite Desert Island Discs.
Oh, I haven't heard that. I haven't read this yet. I read Old Filth recently, which I absolutely loved. And it was because I listened to the Backlisted Pod on Jane Gardam that I read that. Yes, this is a Taiwanese edition of... you get sent foreign editions, which is wonderful, but then you don't know what to do with them. I've got something like some 14 Norwegian editions of Crooked Heart, and I've really tried. I've trained up Norwegian clubs and everything. Nobody ever gives you an answer because nobody wants some obscure, you know, writers.
Or they answer in Norwegian, and you think... Yes, that's true. I have no idea.
But this is a lovely, lovely edition.
Oh, gosh, look at that beautiful illustration. It's lovely, you know, and
the vertical. I think it's read left to right. Yes, yeah, so right to left. And it's you know, the vertical columns of exquisite pictograms or characters, anyway.
Other than, obviously, here and in English-speaking countries, do you know where you're the most popular? Is there a country that...
popular anywhere.
I'm sure you are.
They said France. They did the most beautiful. Oh, look at this! If you think that's beautiful, this is Wed Wabbit in French, which is dans le monde pestaculaire, which is deliberate spoonerism. Et terrible de ma sœur Minnie est de son vilain lapin. So it's basically in the spectacular world, or in the pestacular world of my sister Minnie and her evil rabbit.
Is that octopus the logo of the publishing house?
Yeah, it's really called nice. Poop fiction, as in, you know, it's a really nice pun. But it's a beautiful thing, and I got a little bit arsy about, you know, illustrating these characters called the Wimbly Woos, and I have to say they bent over backwards, and in the end I loved the illustration so much. I just nodded through everything. I thought it was wonderful. It's the most beautiful edition. So maybe France. But I'm very fond of Wed Wabbit. I think it might be my favourite book. It's the book that made me laugh most, writing it.
I'm sure you've been asked this before, and I'm sure it's an annoying question. Could you say that you prefer writing for children or for adults, or would you hate to do one and not the other?
They seem to come from different places, and if I've been squeezing my brain trying to write something for adults, if I then go on to trying to write something for children, you know, maybe on the same day, it feels easier, it feels more relaxed.
They really switch between projects that quickly?
I can. I mean, I mainly don't, because at the moment I'm on the deadline for the adult book, whereas I'm not for the children's, therefore there's no justification to doing it. But just occasionally when I feel really stuck in the adult, I'll go to the children's one that's in progress. And yes, it feels easier, it feels more buoyant. It's like, you know, swimming in fresh water as opposed to salt, you know, it sort of carries you along a bit faster. And I think because children just get on with things more. Mm. You know, they feel things just as deeply, but they don't spend as much time agonising about them, and therefore all that internal dialogue that you end up writing, or I end up writing for adult fiction, doesn't occupy quite the same.
There's no sort of wondering or justification. You know who you are and what you're about, and you crack on.
Yeah, you crack on.
Listen to the grown-ups talking about Latin roots of things. That's right.
So I do enjoy it, my aim, particularly with Wed Wabbit, was to write a funny book for children, and I did make myself laugh a lot doing it, and I was very, very pleased with it. You know, I was very spent a good analogy that's often used. It's not my analogy, but with jokes is their musical nature. You know that you have to hit the beats and you have to feel it's right. And I spend a lot of time reading stuff out loud and thinking, oh, that needs an extra syllable in there, or that's not quite the right word. But when you've got it, you feel so pleased. And I ended up doing the audio book, not because I'm an actress, but because I really knew how these jokes should be told. I knew how it should be read. So I ended up doing the audio book for Wed Wabbit. And there are so many different voices in it. So I had to record, there are these creatures called the Wimbly Woos that come in loads of different colours, and they've all got different, each colour's got a different character. So I had to record each Wimbly Woo on my, phone and you know, play it back when I need it. But Wed Wabbit himself has got a huge screeching voice, and I started losing my voice. So in the end, we recorded all his stuff at the end. but I did enjoy it.
Yeah.
I was really, really proud of it in the end. It was great. And this is the German edition of Wed Wabbit, which is, as you will spot, not a wabbit at all, but a...
fox.
A fox, a Wed Fox. Apparently, because it goes with, well, it's called Fitzfups Muss Weg. So Fitzfups must go. But apparently Cuddly Foxes are big in Germany.
Oh.
Don't ask me why.
I love how the French one, it's a sort of long and very kind of expansive, yes, explanatory, yes, cover with lots of detail. And that's just really sort of, that's three words. Go.
That's right, isn't it funny? Yeah, I got a Norwegian translation of one of my children's books, and I got a couple of notes from the translator. And he was the most meticulous translator ever. And he spotted a couple of typos in the English edition that I hadn't spotted. The copy editor hadn't spotted. The editor hadn't spotted. It was extraordinary. Isn't that amazing? So I admire translators greatly because I'm not a linguist. I don't know. I'm hopeless. Always was.
Well, there's so many different jobs, isn't it? Because it's knowing two languages very well, but also knowing them well enough to kind of do a sense translation as much as a literal one.
Yes. Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Extraordinary. And how they did Wed Wabbit, which is full of puns and rhymes. I mean, my God.
Huge thanks to Lissa. Please do beg or borrow her books and binge them all. They're exactly what we need in these times. And please ask your local independent bookseller if they can get you Old Baggage or their finest Hour and a Half. They really are worth waiting for. It takes a little while to get your books at the moment. I'm Daisy Buchanan and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, fellow paperback chasers. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyB. Also, please follow our brand new social media accounts at YBooked, that's the letter Y and booked on both Twitter and Instagram. Say hello, suggest some guests and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. And we are now on Facebook also. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at ybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think and it helps other people to find the podcast. For now, I leave you with this from Ellen Montgomery. Don't be led away by those howls about realism. Remember, pine woods are just as real as pigsties and a darn sight pleasanter to be in. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.